Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And since we last spoke to you, this World Cup gets even closer. Andy Robinson's now been fired. We'll bring you an update on the next episode as to which coach has been fired to make it more and more in line with the 2007 World Cup as we return to the Squid Rugby World Cup retrospective. I am currently recording from a coffee shop in Cardiff because I am stranded here.
Very professional, not dropping the brand, by the way. Very professional.
Yes, this episode is sponsored by No Brands.
If you're going to supply with coffee through the pod, then you give a shout out.
Yeah.
They'll say, we'll give you a free coffee if you buy eight first. That is our loyalty scheme. I'm joined Zeppa by Will or the other Squidge, whatever you want to call you.
I can't believe you've given me a whatever people want to call me.
Rugby league squish.
We were talking off air a minute ago about the fact that I'm the bigger league fan out of the two of us regular hosts, and that is not saying much. By the way, when I say the two regular hosts, who's the other one?
I'm Robbie Owen, because that's how you introduce yourself by your full name.
The tables have turned.
And we're joined once again, very excited to welcome back our now, I think we can now call you regulars, Harry and Nelson Dale. How are we doing?
Yeah, look, we're going good, mate. You're stranded in cold Wales and we're in nice, warm, almost sunny. It's only just got dark, Australia, so we can't complain.
Yeah, I'm working 4 days a week, enjoying the sun, you know, taking it pretty, getting retirement. It's great down here in Australia, guys. Very, very good.
I cannot overstate how cold it is at Cardiff. Like, friend of the pod, Paul Williams, tweeted it saying this morning, it's so cold in Cardiff that I just saw a penguin crying. And I saw that same penguin. I thought he was joking when I read the tweet. But no.
Very good.
Like, I was saying off air that, you know, normally I think of the Millennium Stadium as this kind of like cathedral of like, you know, you kind of take a pilgrimage to. And then I had the moment this morning of just being like, it's really cold. I just want to get where I'm going. It's now just an obstacle in my way. It's just something massive I've got to walk around. That's what I'm dealing with. That's why you may hear background noise as this goes on. And I apologize for that.
It's penguins crying.
Yeah.
That's something that Sydney does well. We have our major stadium in the middle of bumfuck nowhere. So you're never going to be in your way. It's planned out, thought out really, really well, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You're never going to go there either. So it's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, bear that in mind for when I'm not there.
Yeah. Surely, boys, sure you're going to be at the Australian Rugby World Cup in a few years' time.
When's the Rugby League World Cup coming around again? 4 years?
Oh, I think it's every 2, 3, 5, 4, 7 years. They just make it up as they go. Yeah.
I wonder who's going to be in the final of that one.
Look, well, Namibia are having a huge driving force at the moment. They've really brought it together. So they've actually taken a lot of their union players and they're really going to give it a shake, I think.
They once made it to 4 on the tackle count. So they're a really up and coming nation.
That's pretty tough against, you know, a country like, I don't know, Papua New Guinea. Like if they could do that against Australia, they're in for a chance.
Genuinely, the game we're about to talk about, Japan, I don't know that they ever did make it to 4 on the tackle count.
So, first 20, they were defending.
Nah, mate, we just knocked the ball on.
Yeah, that's true.
Can I ask before we start, though, about the ball that Bernard Foley couldn't kick? Which.
The ball that I own now?
Yeah.
You own that ball.
How did that happen?
Oh, honestly, it's just purely rugby not being that big and, you know, out there in Australia at the moment. There was eToro, you know, was the of the Wallabies or Parts concert for the comp, and they just put something up on Twitter, and I swear like 10 people retweeted it and commented, you had to write like some poem or something like that and send it to Michael. And I spent actually far too long when I, you know, came up against a few other probably 10-year-olds. And I got it now. And
if it goes on number of tweets, Nelson has, he's famous for having almost every single rugby account on Twitter in Australia. So he's just retweeting off every single one of his accounts, which made him an absolute
It was a short hit.
Do you remember your poem that won you the ball, the infamous ball?
I really
ball?
Wish I did. I could probably look for it, but I really, really wish I had it. Harry's looking it up now just to see if he can find it. It's going to be about 1,000 posts back because it was like a month ago.
I love the thought of moments in cult rugby history being given out for poetry competitions.
I don't even fully remember how good it was. I'm going to put my money on this is going to be embarrassing. When
I mean,
out.
I would write a few stanzas for an NFT if Gareth Edwards was just try it for the Barbarians.
I was going to say, like, so an anecdote I don't think I've told on the podcast is I once accidentally came third in a prestigious poetry competition by talking about Jason Statham. And if only I'd known that I could have won the shirt Gareth Edwards was wearing in 1973, then maybe I would have tried.
Yeah, you would have put in the extra effort for sure. Like, look, honestly, they just said it was a match ball. That's all they said when they put it up. And then when I won it, I private messaged them. I'm like, guys, can I just double check this is the ball at the end of the match? And they go, I'll double check for you. Came back and said, it's the ball.
No.
I'm trying to not, like, I don't want to push it too far, guys, but can I get, like, a letter of authentication and stuff like that from Australia? Like, yeah, no problem. And then they sent me all that out, and it's signed by both captains. And so I'm going to put it in there.
They were saying we think that it should have clearly been Reynal and
Nick White.
Foley.
Yeah. Like, if ever you meet Bernard Foley, you have to bring that with you everywhere you go in case you bump into him.
That's some good shithousery, but I really want to do that. So it definitely makes it just that much better if I can get it. I'll just put it to a different ball.
Where is that ball now sat in your house?
It's just sitting. I've got a signed Waratahs jersey from the year that we never won a game. From two last season, sitting on a shelf in my in-law's place. So it's not boxed up. It's not done anything special at the moment. So I know a guy that's going to, you know, make him look very professional and get some big printout photos and stuff like that for me.
Oh, amazing. That's brilliant.
He's about that game we lost.
It's more famous that happened though. If he kicked it, the ball's not that exciting.
I did kind of forget the repercussions of him not kicking it for just for a minute there when you were so proud of that ball.
That's the thing. It's going to be remembered as one of the Wallaby losses, and you forever will never be able to forget it.
When I got the ball, like I put up on Twitter a vote saying like, what should I do with this ball? And one of the options was kick it into touch, and that one. I'm like, should I frame it? Should I kick it into touch? Everyone's like, kick it into touch.
You have to.
I really want to film me just kicking the ball into touch, and just go like make a bit of a pun out of it. And he couldn't get it done, so I'll get it done.
We will promo the shit out of that video when that surfaces.
The thing is,
I'll make it happen.
Thing is, you have waited months now. Foley only waited an extra minute.
I'll go get it now. I'll be back.
That would have been a hell of an exclusive. We did that as an audio. You kicking the ball
as an audio. That would have told really well over podcast format. People would have really loved it.
Nelson's walking to the ball, and
the whistle's been blown. He's shot.
It doesn't make touch, so.
And yeah, Harry, you can play Nick White and Vachetti and all the players telling him that he has to kick it into touch. You can be that guy because I can see by you two on Twitter that you're not shy of occasionally having a go at each other.
I stand by that Nick White was supporting his teammate. They were all saying that he's doing such a good job at getting ready to kick the ball. They were that impressed.
Go, you
good
thing.
Yeah, there's no way they were blowing up. Yeah. I don't agree with that. Yeah. I refute that.
I'm pretty sure they were going, you've got more time, take your time.
Any success on the poem, by the way?
Look, I've dead set scrolled through the most outrageous amount of content from Nelson, but nothing, absolutely nothing.
I'll find it.
Okay. In the meantime, I will mention the game today for it's Australia 91, Japan 3. A scoreline that flatters Japan.
Yeah. This is the biggest scoreline we've had on this podcast, is it not?
Is it?
I don't think we've had somebody hit 90 points yet. I think that the previous biggest was, I think, South Africa beat Namibia 87-0. And I think New Zealand might have got 88 or something against Japan in 2011. But certainly in 1987, people couldn't catch the ball enough times to score 90 points.
Yeah, that's very true. But this one was interesting as well. I saw just before I came over that this was the most caps from a starting 15 ever for the Wallabies.
Wow.
And I don't think it was that many. Like, it's obviously they didn't play as many games back then, but
when they were South Africa.
It was like 700 odd or something like
that. Right, right.
Like, this is the most that's ever taken a field in international rugby.
Was it, wow. It was 6-0 after 15 minutes, and all the commentators going, wow, Japan, you know, they're just sticking in it. They really aren't letting this game get away. What is it, 20? What was the halftime score? It was still tight, 23-3, thinking they're having a proper crack here. They're expected to score 80 to 100 points. And then, as I said, they play the Namibian rugby league tactic in defense. Outrageous.
I want to add as well, speaking of funny kind of kit dramas, Harry, you're currently on this podcast wearing your Wallabies 2007 jersey. So what kind of relationship do you have with this Wallaby team?
You know what? I bought this jersey very enthusiastically pre-World Cup. Nelson and I probably fell in love with rugby, particularly in the 2003 home World Cup, maybe the few years before that as well. And I bought this jersey and I was so happy with it because it was the first jersey that had these like little grip pads on the chest. And I just thought that it was like the most outstanding thing as a, I don't know, it's probably pretty old, 19-year-old.
No, I was in year 10. So you'd have been, what?
2007? 19-year-old. And now I realize I just hate the jersey. It's so thick and hot. It doesn't move. It's a lot tighter than I remember, which is definitely
the jersey's fault. Especially in the gun.
Yeah. So no, it's not my favorite jersey, but I hold on to every single one. And I remember being particularly excited about the design at the time.
It's one of those jerseys you still see at every Wallabies game. You still see people wearing it all the time, that shirt. With the piping and the, as you said, the grip pads and everything.
I think you probably find that like 2003, so many people started getting into rugby, the World Cup in Australia. So random people would have gone, oh, the next World Cup, we're going to win this one and just got on board. And
it's probably the sign that no one's bought a jersey since 2007. I think it's probably like,
the hope's gone. That's what it is.
Maybe we'll see that again next time. Maybe we'll see an influx of, 2031 jerseys for the next 20 years beyond that.
That's it a good one to be a sponsor on. They should sell that. That's smart. It's going to be worth far more.
It's referred to at one point as Lottie Tinkuri is wearing a controversial jumper.
I think it's definitely the grip stuff. I remember it being quite controversial.
It was cheating, it was basically cheating. I think after they watched this game, they realised that it didn't have quite the performance-enhancing effects that they thought, with the backs dropping almost every single wide pass in the first half. But I think maybe that was a tax just so that they had it for the finals when they really needed it for that one game.
I do think these two teams should have swapped jerseys at halftime so we could have seen the effects of it. But, you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
Could have measured it accurately.
It was an interesting one, really. Like, I think they were talking about Australia were expecting John Connolly were going 0 points to be scored against us. And I don't know what point it was. We were like maybe 20 up or something like that, 17 up or something when Japan kicked their penalty. And I wonder if John Connolly at the time is going, that's disgusting. Like, I'm not happy about that. And how angry he really was. 23-3,
just before halftime.
At that point, my first thought was, because this is the scheduled draft rugby episode that we have on every season of our podcast, right? I was thinking, like, go on, lads. I can't wait for your drop kick in the second half. And because that drop kick didn't happen, I feel like later on the pod, when we get to that point, we have to really, really build up this penalty and really, really go into depth about it as much as we do any Wallabies try, if not more.
That's a very valid point. That's very disappointing. That, I mean, you guys picked the wrong game for us. There's no drop goal against us.
Yeah. So Matt Dunning was on the field, so it was always a chance. Infamous, obviously, for his drop goal in Super Rugby. Speaking about Dunning, he made a couple breaks. He was
Dunning was. Yeah.
Two or three line breaks, pretty quick.
Also, just generally, I want to say, I enjoyed this game a lot.
Yeah, I did.
To say it was so insanely one-sided, and genuinely, there was a point about kind of 50 minutes where I forgot Japan were playing, and I forgot that it wasn't just like the Wallabies doing essentially a training session, but I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, it was good fun. It was interesting to hear the commentators go, oh, it's just not been the day for the Japanese centre pairing at one point. And it's like,
they were pretty brutal too.
Jeez, like, they've had the ball in total for 5 minutes and it's maybe got to the centres once. And he's tearing those two players apart.
Should we have a quick look at the teams while we're here? So should we start with Japan?
Let's start with Japan, okay.
Because we're there.
Japan in a really weird place leading into this World Cup. So they had, a few years after the 2003 World Cup, appointed Jean-Pierre Elissard, former France international, to be their head coach through to the 2007 World Cup. However, about a year before this World Cup, in 2006, right, Elissard signed on to become the coach of Bayonne in the top 14 and didn't tell Japan. And so he was planning on just doing both jobs at the same time and just hoping Japan wouldn't find out he was also coaching another professional team full time. So they found out about 2 months into the French season and fired him.
Oh, all right. And
so his deal was that I will, for the duration of the World Cup, I will offer to go full time with Japan. And
which he already is.
Yeah.
I will honour the job that I signed a contract off for 2 months.
Jeez, that's some good stuff from him. That's some really, really good stuff.
It's the first case of a Frenchman working too much that anyone's ever seen.
Guessing by the fact we don't see Elissard, I think we can probably guess what happened to him.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they brought in John Kerwin, who is a very well-known guy in rugby, but geez, like, have you seen him recently? Whenever he's talking on the telly, it's always controversial. He looks like he's taken too many hits to the head. And I actually saw him in this one and gone, he's coherent. Like, this is a sign that they did not look after players' heads back then. Could you listen to him now? And you go, geez, this guy's not all there. And
I do wonder how he's got so many concussions after finishing footy, though. You would think as a coach you shouldn't be getting more concussions and deteriorating.
That was how Eddie Jones got the job off him.
The one bit of punditry that John Kerwin has done recently that really stands up and makes sense when you watch this game back is he said a few weeks ago, I was never a very good coach.
Yeah, I heard that. I remember hearing that. Like, he did pretty much the opposite of what Jones did when he came in, because he's like, we're versing a good team, we're not going to play our players. Like, we're going to put out a weakened team against Australia and then we're going to have a real crack at Fiji, who they did come close to be fair.
They had only a 4-day turnaround as well, right? So they had a pretty tough game to back up from.
John Kerwin in the pre-match is referred to as John Kerwin who scored that famous try against Italy, not John Kerwin, who scored that famous try with a dog on the field against Italy.
Which, ridiculous. Why does no one bring it up? Why does no one mention it?
I can't believe it took this long to come up in the podcast, to be honest. Yeah, I thought you guys had to drop that into the opener for every episode.
We should.
They ask John Kerwin before the match, what are you happy for out this fixture? And he, without skipping a beat, just goes, respect.
Yeah,
no dogs in the field.
No respect for that. No respect.
I don't know that they really got that either. I think it was a pretty solid fail in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. So looking at the Japanese team itself, I think there's a handful of quite recognisable names going on. I mean, for starters, right, Kosai Ono started both in this game and their win over the Springboks in 2015, which is pretty remarkable.
Before the game, they asked John Kerwin, you're down to your third choice fly half. And he goes, it's not a third choice. It's just a young guy who's coming through. And when I heard that, I was like,
Okay, come on.
Right
on.
And mate, then you realize, like, oh no, it is the guy that goes on to start their way over the Springboks in however long time.
It's pretty remarkable actually seeing a younger version of him. So he didn't go to 2011, did he? So he skipped that World Cup but went to 2007 and 2015. Mm. Oh no. They do make a pun on his name and say, oh, he might be saying, oh no, a lot during the game if the Wallabies score some tries.
Yeah, coming up against Larkham, he'll be saying, oh no.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. But so it's interesting as well that pre-match they refer to him as being quite a, like, kicking 10, which in kind of since then isn't the reputation he has, which clearly shows kind of the reputation of Eddie Jones and kind of what he transformed him into come the 2015 tournament.
Well, because you look at that Japan team now, right? And Ono and Tatakawa were basically Ford and Farrell. And I don't know if he just has to find two players that become that with any team he plays in. And that was like, he was clearly building Matt Gitto to be one day when he was with the Wallabies. And he wants Stephen Larkham. He just wants endless Stephen Larkhams. And he will make them if he has to. The other thing about the Munster, the other thing that's interesting about the Japan team is they played a warm-up game about 2 weeks before this against Portugal, in which Dasuki Iwata got himself injured and ruled out of the tournament.
Oh.
Who was, of course, the world-leading try scorer.
Oh, I'm gutted we didn't get a chance to see him. I'd assumed he'd retired by this point.
No, he was still going. This was supposed to be a swan song. So and he got injured just before the tournament against Portugal.
They had a pretty big build-up as well. Like, they did the Pacific Nations Cup and came up against Australia A and lost 71-10. So, I mean, this could have gone a lot worse.
Yeah.
It's a clear sign of how the difference between Australia and Australia A, in that they score exactly 20 more points and don't concede a try.
But this was essentially Australia versus Japan A. So, I don't know. I feel like it's probably par, isn't it? They're about as good.
I feel like Australia A would probably give Australia a run for the money, wouldn't they?
Well, I mean, again, this year, our Australia A side looked pretty bloody good. They beat Japan a few times in a row, didn't they?
Yeah.
Like two out of three.
Two out of three.
Yeah, it's rock solid. They're better, that's a better win rate than our Wallabies.
On the wing, they have brought in a young Hirotaki Onizawa as well, who is now speaking retrospectively, their second top try scorer, to Iwata. Bless him. You can tell he's talented, right? But he doesn't get a lot of opportunity in this game. He is rapid, but like, he's not as quick as Lotte Tinkuri. So that's kind of the one thing that matters.
It's a tough gig, that, isn't it?
It is. It's being a tough gig.
We'll get onto it in a moment, but it's a hell of a Wallabies backline to find yourself up against. To say, like, there's some players that go on to have good careers for Japan, like Koji Taira, I think, you know, played very well for them later on.
Really good in 2011.
Katsu Kasumi, good player. There's plenty of players who are entirely talented, but it is a
Sasaki,
bit.
The captain, I like the look
who
of.
So he'd been the captain under Elisade. He then got dropped by Ota, who was the kind of caretaker coach before Kerwin came in. Then Kerwin immediately reinstated him as captain.
Love it.
The last Japanese player I want to kind of single out is the one that they went mad for on the commentary, and that is Lautangi Samurai Vatuve, which his middle name is genuinely Samurai. So
Yes,
that's genuine. So we once talked about his brother on the 2011 series.
Oh,
so his brother Manu Vatuve played one game in 2011 against Tonga, and we both gave him man of the match, I believe.
He was a big rugby league player and very, very well known player.
Right.
Yeah. So he played for New Zealand and rugby.
I should have known.
He was known for, like, cutting people in half and being a real, real physical player.
Right. Yeah. Because
this is the early commitment to Vatuvei having that kind of nickname as well. Like, Vatuvei is such a good Japanese surname. It just fits so well with Samurai. It's like they knew that his destiny was to play for Japan. It's just,
surely it can't be his birth middle name.
It's written down on the team sheet as Samurai Vatuvei. Like,
yeah,
that
I
being
he
a surname.
Might have adopted that when he wanted to be selected, though, surely.
That's true. There's probably some Granny Gate stuff going on. Of just, they're like, my middle name is Samurai. Of course I'm Japanese.
Interesting thing. Their other brother, Sione Vatuvei, played for Japan in the 2003 World Cup.
Oh, wow.
So did they just have a different one each World Cup?
Got a rota.
They just had to take turns.
I think Manu actually might be a cousin and Sione a brother.
Oh, okay.
And Sione, I'm pretty sure that it was last year or this year they had the Samurai 15, Tongan Samurai 15 or something like that. It was all
Tongan
guys. And I'm pretty sure he was their captain.
Right.
Yeah, so he's still around, or was still around at some point within the last 12 months playing footy in Japan.
Interesting, really interesting. Cool. I've just noticed, by the way, looking back, Japan just do not use their bench in this game. They only bring one substitute on.
Yeah, John Kerwin, not a very good coach.
Yeah, because I saw in the anthem like that they had Hitoshi Ono in there and realised, oh yeah, he's on the bench. And they had Bryce Robbins, who, again, we talked about once in 2011 and was class. And like Kazuki Endo, who was great in 2011. So they have a lot of players on the bench that they just don't bring on, clearly saving them back for later in the tournament. So that's something exciting to look forward to.
I think as well that Kerwin could tell that it was just about to tip. You know, the Japanese had him right where they wanted him. 60th, 70th minute when the Wallabies were starting to tire, they could see they were going to bring the new subs on. The Wallabies' cohesion was going to go out the window and the tired Japanese were going to hit their second wind. So, you know, I can see the tactic. I get it. Didn't quite pan out, but I would have done the same if I was him.
Yeah, yeah. Just forget to bring everyone on. Yeah, yeah. Of course, so we've talked a lot about, like, great scrum half battles on World Cups and stuff.
Okay.
Like, we've talked about, like, Dmitry Ashvili. We've talked about Fori Dupriya, a lot of the brilliant scrum halves in the world. But this is a really exciting moment because there's two scrum halves here that we get to commentate on for the first time in World Cups. Yeah. And it is probably my favourite battle of the scrum halves that I've ever seen, in George Gregan versus Yuki Yatomi.
Mate, how many times did they say Yuki Yatomi, a George Gregan-like halfback? And then they go, but he has too much hair. Or something like that as well. And he did end up being a bald guy. So, I mean, maybe they could tell the future.
But I think that's it. I think they just saw a bald scrum up and were just like, brilliant. Here he is. Gregan-like.
Yuki Itomi is a scrum half I have very fond memories of because I first saw him playing his latter like days of his career for the Sunwolves in Super Rugby.
Yes.
And he very much branched into one of my favourite kinds of rugby player is fat scrum halves. I say that because I intend to be one very soon. But so we're talking like Ricky January, right? What a player. Okay.
Yeah.
Piru Whipu, what a player.
Yes.
The late great Taniela Moa. Brilliant player. Yuki Yatomi is very much fitting into that kind of that breed of rugby player.
Emphasis on the word fit.
Yes, exactly. I just love him. He looks like a nugget.
Apparently, if you flick over to his Wikipedia, apparently he played wing as well.
Not a chance. Not a chance.
Yeah,
they definitely didn't see, Oata's out, Yuki, see if you can jump on the flank for us.
Yes, I'm probably in the same way Jake Gordon plays wing, you know? Like, yeah. There's no one left on the pitch. All right, come on, Yuki, get out there.
Yeah, yeah. Like, Nick Phipps has, like, 15 caps on the wing. He just happened to play at the same time as Genia. That's all that means.
Yeah, this is typical of Australian behaviour as well. Like, in this game, no backup halfback. Accordingly, not on the team sheet. So they had Matt Giddo as the backup nine if anything went down. So if the halfbacks are just, you know, they're able to be put anywhere, I wouldn't have been surprised if we finished with Gitz there and Georgie Gregan playing out in the wing or, you know, wherever they were going to try and make the team sheet fit because that's just what the halfbacks do.
They had a couple bench halfbacks. They had Drew Mitchell, they had Mark Gerardigafil, and they had Stephen Hoyles, who they did put there at one point at blindside wing.
George Smith could have played there, let's be honest.
You definitely could have put George Smith anywhere on the field.
Well, I mean, two notes. One, I was just going to mention that Ryo Yamamura, the Japanese tight head, was a former sumo wrestler. Who ended his sumo career to focus on rugby because he enjoyed rugby more. And good on him. And you mentioned Stephen Hoyles, head coach of the LA Guillotinis, the MLR-winning coach now.
I forgot about that. Yeah, good player, Stephen Hoyles. Mm. I didn't really get a chance to see him play internationally when I was first like getting into rugby. So I kind of thought him as a super rugby player, so I'm looking forward to seeing kind of what he's like at this level.
He was a gun, actually. We really rated him when he was playing in Australia. And then he's had a pretty good coaching career, too. Been pretty heavily involved with the Australian Sevens, Randwick, and over in, and I think he was assistant coach before head coach now over at the Guillotinis as well. So I actually genuinely think he's got a pretty big future. I think we'll probably see him back in Australia in the next few years.
That's class. Speaking of the Australian backline, because that's the highlight of this game.
The sound I made when I saw that back line just on the team sheet.
There's no weakness to it.
And it's this really fun thing of this is kind of a transition period for Australia in that you've still got a lot of the star players from 2003, but you've got a lot of the players that would go on to be key in that really great 2011 backline.
Yeah.
And you've kind of got them meeting here. It's such a satisfying group.
A couple who made the final in 2015 in Gitto and Ashley Cooper.
And Mitchell on the bench.
But you got Lotti Tenkuri and Adam Ashley Cooper on the wings, which is fantastic. That midfield of Larkham, Gitto and Mortlock.
It's
delightful. And the thing is, we say all of that. We've not spoken about the guy who all of the pre-match chat was around Chris Latham. On his 32nd birthday, this was.
Yes. Birthday boy.
Yeah. He didn't get much ball, but when he did, he was just unbelievable.
It was so typical of Latham, the way he runs as well. Apparently, he did his ACL, MCL, had a big knee recon at the start of the year.
Oh, wow.
Hadn't played any test footy before this competition. Came straight in and played like that. Every time he ran the ball, he's just got that that really iconic leg drive through contact. There was that one moment early in the first half where he's kicked a ball from inside his own 22 and it's gone out just outside the 22 of the Japanese team. And it just gave me flashbacks to playing rugby 08 as a kid. And you used to just punt the ball into open space. The defense could never work it out. And you'd make about 80 meters. And Latham just had this endless boot in the game. He's just such a hero.
What about his double kick? He got the ball off. The ball comes down the 71st minute down from a Japanese kick. He gets the ball, chips it over the top as it lands, basically grabs it again, burns everybody and ends up scoring 80 meters with a couple of kicks along the way.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
That was a pretty good try.
Yeah, yeah. That was one of the pick of the bunch to kind of jump ahead to that.
Yeah.
This is also immediately pre-Worcester Chris Latham.
Of course!
This is him, straight after his World Cup, he heads to Worcester, who at the time were, not going great in the Premiership, but they went, we know how we can fix this. Let's spend what at the time it made him the second highest paid player in Premiership rugby history.
Wow.
Second to Carl Heyman at Newcastle. And he came in and you know what? He did okay. And Worcester continued to finish. Yeah. Worcester continued to finish in the bottom half of the table.
We still haven't replaced him. We haven't got a fullback. I wouldn't mind him putting the boots on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Second highest top try scorer of Wallaby history to David Campese. He's just big on seconds. Yeah. He's big on being second in everything.
I would say he's going to come up in my awards at the end of the pod, though. So
okay.
I'll hold the little teaser. But he's definitely
noted. Noted. So as we get to the pre-match, I have two things that I want to point out.
Okay.
The first of which is this fantastic piece of punditry in the pre-game, which I loved, okay?
And you can see, as Phil Wall pointed out, all the guys with different ways of preparing. You see Beric Barnes with the headphones on. Georgie Gregan had the headphones on. Lottie Tenkuri with the earpieces. Georgie Gregan, I would gamble on him listening to a bit of jazz leading up to this event. And I'm not just saying that because I like jazz, but I happen to know that George does too. So I'd expect maybe a bit of Miles Davis would be in those headphones. John Connolly.
Wow. The variety is just insane.
Wasn't it? Then the next minute, things got better because it was looking at John Connolly speak and we couldn't hear him. I don't know. Was that just me?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That happened.
And it is still better than what we just heard. More insightful.
There's no Miles Davis. We should have just been listening in there.
You like jazz?
Yeah, that's surely how you guys start the pod this week.
Yeah. We should, instead of doing this about the rugby, just speculate on players' musical tastes.
I like how he specifies this. I'm not saying that because I like jazz. It's well, it would have been interesting if George Gregan listened to jazz because the commentator, Rupert McCall, likes it.
Oh, he's just taking a stab in the dark. He likes jazz, and Georgie Gregan's listening to some hip-hop, and he's just going, he's definitely listening to jazz. Trust me, I like it. It's good stuff.
Gregan's too angry for hip-hop. He needs the jazz to mellow him out.
Yeah,
common knowledge.
It is nice, knowing that George Gregan's a jazz fan, though. It's, as you say, it's good that he has that calming influence in his life. That's a good thing to know. So the second thing I have before kickoff, right? So we've talked about something that's really calming in George Gregan and his jazz addiction. He just loves jazz. All he does is listen to jazz, right? But the other thing I noticed when the national anthems started to happen, Stephen Moore has hair!
Yeah. What's that about?
So weird. It was really odd seeing it. I saw him throw a line out. I'm like, who's that?
Yeah, I didn't recognize him until the second half of the game when someone said, you know, the commentator said Moore. I was like, oh, as in Stephen Moore.
It can't be the same guy.
No, he looks like a baby. It's like when I see photos of Nelson with hair, like, he's not the same human.
It's fake news, that. It's fake news.
It's bald as Nelson 2.0, and I'm not sure Moore is the same. Better without hair. It's overrated.
Anything else from the pre-game?
I thought it was interesting, the ref, I'm just double-checking his name,
Alan Lewis, yes.
Yeah. He was an Irish cricketer with an average of over 50. That's not bad.
That's
pretty interesting. He couldn't catch a ball because Gregan almost, you know, he got in the way of a pass to Gregan at one point. But
Matty Dunning throwing it into him,
yeah. But that's pretty interesting, an international cricketer being ref.
They do, of course, on the touch judges, have both Dave Pearson and Steve Walsh.
Yes.
Which is, it's the dream team of officiating.
Why couldn't they have co-refereed the game instead of Alan Lewis?
I know.
Just have the two of them bicker over every decision.
I'll tell you what, at the time, I remember thinking Alan Lewis was an all right referee, but I don't miss him.
No, he is incredibly pedantic on everything.
At one point, he literally shushes Matt Dunning.
I think he refereed the scrum like you would expect a professional cricketer referee a scrum. He just generally what was going on. In the second half, he's like, all right, guys, you just need to calm down and just do better. Like, I'm not getting anywhere here myself, so please just fix the problem.
Yeah.
There's one point where Japan have an overlap and they're trying to get it out and they kind of like, in trying to throw the quick hands, they kind of knock it on forward, they kind of bat it forward. And Alan Lewis waits until the winger picks it up and has a little run before he calls it back for the scrum. It's like sadistic. Maybe he was waiting to see if it got to a boundary, I don't know. But like it felt sadistic to just give them hope and then take it away.
He was probably hoping they didn't have to scrum it down again because that was a lottery. And at one point, I'm pretty sure he goes, I don't want to card anyone. And I'm pretty sure it's because he didn't know who to card.
Yeah. He just raises his finger slowly.
Yeah. Okay. All of you go. You know who it is. You go now.
Yeah. There's one thing that it's never happened on this pod before, but it's definitely going to become a regular feature for a few World Cups, right? We get our first ever instance on this podcast of George Gregan chirping. And it is relentless, even when he's like 40 points up. And Gregan, as we've touched on, plays the full game. Mm. But like, there's a point, right, in the first half where Gregan is tackled like off the ball, essentially. And then it mellows out for a minute. Nothing really happens. Oh, yeah. And then suddenly you see five Japanese players just swarm on him, ready to punch him. And you just know, you can't hear it on the ref mic, but you know he has just said something really, like, probably offensive to one of the Japanese players. And it's just like, yep, that's our first ever Gregan chirp on this podcast. You've got,
do you know
we'd
what
love
he actually
to see
does?
It.
He runs over, and if it's the same moment, and grabs one of them by the head and almost rips the player's head off.
Oh, yeah.
The bloke sackwhacks him. That was the response. Yeah. That's why he got upset, because he runs over when there's a stoppage of play, grabs the guy around the throat, and then as the guy drops to the floor, he whacks him in the nuts. And that's why the big mob starts.
We've always got to defend the Aussie. It wasn't his fault.
But
what's
Gregan,
worse, head off for him,
they both grabbed each other's head, and I think Gregan did the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
Gregan is chaotic if nothing else, though. Like, literally in the last minute when Australia are 80 points up, at one point Gregan is held late again by a Japanese player. And he kind of does that kind of like pseudo stamp thing to get him off him. And you can hear on the ref mic just somebody shouting, "You cunt." As Gregan goes over to take a quick tap, Lewis says, "No, you can't take that because of what you just said. Like, do not do that again." But he says that when there's 1 minute left on the clock. And the worst thing about that is, that's entirely valid. 60 seconds is a lot of time for George Gregan to call somebody else a cunt.
I did not realise that's what he said. I saw the big blow up and the ref like stopping in his tracks.
Yeah.
I did not hear that on the ref mic.
I love that because it was Australia, they didn't apologise for any language being picked up. They were just like, you're used to it.
It means something different in Australia. It's endearing here, right? If we call each other cunts, it's because we like
it. It's very kind of Gregan to say that, actually. It's rugby values right there. And Alan Lewis just misinterpreted it.
Yeah. If he called him buddy or something like that, or, you know, it would be really mean. He called him a cunt because he liked him.
Yeah. So Gregan gets positive. It's in his good books, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
You guys are being so harsh on him. Yeah.
I thought this was going to be like the drag ends of Gregan's career, and like he'd intended to retire in 2003, and he went, you know what, he was so pissed off by the Wilkinson drop goal, he went, I'm just going to keep going, just going to keep going. And I thought this was going to be him like with waning powers, and he's really good.
I expected him to look a little bit like a Pirouette type scrum half, you know?
Yeah, I shouldn't be surprised. George Gregan was really good.
He was so good.
He was incredible.
Like, the first thing that happens in the game is Kosciuszko shanks a kickoff, and then George Gregan sends back a box kick, which is, like, on the money. Yeah. And, like, he just about, like, he gets it so it's just shallower than where the Japanese backfield are, and it bounces into touch. And this is a minor event in a game with, like, 10-odd tries. But still, like, it's brilliant that, like, he had that game management thing from the off.
Mm.
His kicking game in this match was absolutely superb. Yeah. There was one moment where he picks up and runs open and then puts the box kick back towards the blind side for Dunning and Latham.
Yes.
For Dunning. I assume Dunning called for it. And it almost results in a try, if not for Latham knocking the ball on. But Matty Dunning calling for the chip and chase, I assume is what happened on the blind side play.
Yeah.
It's just an exceptional kick from Gregan as well. Everything he did off the boot was fantastic.
It's insane that he showed that he's like capable of playing kind of both brands of rugby that Australia did in this game. Because like when Japan was still pushing them and was still full of a bit of energy, you know, he was doing the kicking game thing and still like and putting them under pressure. And then when Australia could just let rip, he was just finding holes left, right and centre.
There's a moment.
He was very heavily criticised late in his career for taking a couple of steps to pass the ball and how much he slowed the ruck down and the play of the ball down because of that. And I didn't get a sense of that at all in this game, particularly off set piece when Japan had pretty high line speed.
He did take steps, but the thing was it was always to kind of pull someone across or like find that gap and kind of weight the pass correctly and things. It wasn't like a halfback that needed to take the steps to get the length on their pass or to buy themselves time. It was actually to try and, you know, sit up the defensive line. And it was definitely a tactic I think he used really well.
The thing that really stood out to me was just how fast he is. Because he isn't lining up his pass. He's picking it up the moment it's available and spinning it away. Like, he is adding so much more pace than we ever see, like, nowadays. Like, it was... I had moments of thinking, oh, the Wallabies doing things now that if you just drop them into a modern system, they'd work. And A, there was a Japanese defense, so it's unfair. But B, I think actually the difference is just how George Gregan was playing.
Yeah.
The pace he was adding, so how much he was adding kind of in like value added on each pass. He wasn't just whipping it away.
On
as he was tying plays in, he was like turning eyes.
Yeah. On what we've done on this podcast, I've scarcely seen a player who reads the game as well as George Gregan does.
Yeah.
That, like, every time the Wallabies made a break, he was always, like, the man linking up and anticipating that. And he must have got, like, genuinely, like, 4 or 5 assists in this game just from that.
One of my favourite moments in this game is the Berrick Barnes try, which I'm just going to skip ahead. You know, Berrick Barnes' first touch of international rugby, and George Gregan puts him in for a try. And... so there's and I think that'd be his last try that wasn't against Wales. so he then, Gregan, it has that look of, you know, when you play a video game so much that you're no longer playing the game consciously, you're just reacting to the animations because you know it inside out. And you're just like, oh, this character's moving their arms. That means I've got to press the X button, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, Gregan looks like that playing international rugby. Like, he's kind of like half-hearted, not really focused, but he's doing it flawlessly. Like, he's just been doing this so long and he knows it so inside out.
He goes like, oh yeah, there's a prop in front of me. That means to go on the outside of him.
Yeah. So he just drifts on the outside. He doesn't even look once to see if there's people around. Doesn't look for his support. Just lifts it perfectly so that if there is anyone there, they're run onto it.
That little dummy on the inside and then lift on the outside to Barnes is just exquisite.
A good line by Barnes, that little switch around as well. But they just, it's like they knew exactly where each other was and that. pass was just perfect, perfect positioning.
He was on like 130-something caps at that time, which was just absolutely unheard of. So he probably had seen the frames that you're talking about that many frigging times. He could just press X and score a try. Like, yeah. Outrageous.
Yeah.
Just crazy stuff. Absolutely amazing.
Just the man standing outside him, Stephen Larkham. He's class as well throughout this one. I had some
notes on the wall of his tactics, and one of my lines was, Stephen Larkham is a wizard, and that's all it said.
Yeah, it's just that about does it.
It does become very clear that he's like a cheat code in the first half, isn't he, when they're breaking down the opposition D. Like, there's that Elsom try where he throws the inside ball, and it's like he's calculated that clearly about four phases in advance. Like, this defence is shit as long as I make them, like, all work this way, and then, oh no, you should have gone that way. Especially with a man as big as and powerful as Elsom. Like,
he literally, it was around this time actually, or a couple, actually, it might have been a couple years before, when I started playing rugby with Ben Volavola, and he turned up for training, and he literally, we're playing touch footy, and he's the guy that would get the ball, and then he'd tell you where to go and just put you in space, and you just like, you were like, and we're talking about Xbox games, you're that runner that just runs a line. You don't get to choose it. They just pull you through the line. And that's what it was like playing with Benny Volavola at that age. But he's doing it at this level, like international footy, and just looking like he's passing a footy around and creating gaps left, right, and center. He's a freak talent.
He had so much time. He had this ability to just make it look like the defense was standing still. And he could just kind of orchestrate them and move them away rather than actually dictate what happened with the ball.
Yeah, for sure. What was the there was another try where he throws a miss pass. Was that Elsom again? Where he throws a miss pass.
They're all Rocky Elsom.
And again, like, you can tell he's mapping it out the whole time. Like, the build-up play in the 22 is fantastic, and he's always just picking runners off him until eventually he finds that mismatch on the short side.
And Gregan, again, his little switch in there. I mean, there's two factors there. One is he looks up, he sees it's Matt Dunning calling for the ball from 10 on the other side, and he goes, nope. I mean, he's probably going to drop
a goal. We want 7
again.
Points, not 3. Yeah.
Yeah. But the other thing is, him picking and sniping one way, then reverse passing it the other way, straight to Larkham, does tie everyone in. No one is expecting that. Yeah. And so when Larkham then throws a perfect miss pass as well, and you've got two players, like, back to back, throwing these incredible, really whiffy passes. It's exceptional. It's almost undefendable.
The Wallabies love a switch, don't they?
Passes.
We love the switch and loved an offload. Like, they kept saying, this is the World Cup of the offload. And geez, we threw a lot of offloads in that match. I thought another brilliant Larkham moment, even though it didn't come off. Like, he was a man that would back himself no matter what. And he did that one crossfield kick. I think he did some bad kicks, but or kicks that didn't come off.
You've already vented to me about the other kick.
But he did a crossfield kick, the one that Lottie should have caught, and they started going, oh, the sun must have been in his eyes or something like that. It was just like a random kick, attacking line at the 22, and lands like perfectly in the corner of the field.
It was dead set like a video game animation again. I can't believe, like, when you play those old footy games, you were wondering why the hell when you set up for a crossfield kick, it just pushed all your backs out to the touchline and then they kind of all ran together for the kick. It was like that. They had three outside backs running 30 metres away on the other side of the field, and he puts this huge bomb cross kicker, which lands 1 metre out from the line. It's only that Takiri runs over the ball by 5 metres that they don't score. It's just on the money, pinpoint again.
Yeah. And yet, Kasumi, the Japanese fullback, comes up with the ball and goes. And it's brilliant. The thing is, because naturally I looked at that and thought, kick it, because the Australian will have no backfield. But he does brilliantly and steps inside and offloads to Wanazawa, who
then finds Taira.
Yeah, and, or fails to, because it's a poor pass, really. Yeah. And he knocks it on, but they made a good, like, 40-odd yards off that. But, like, that moment when it was 0-0 and Onizawa is jetting up down the, like, down the field. And there's a part of you that wonders, what if that was Iwata?
Away. Try time.
Yeah.
That's it. It's, when I look back on it, it's kind of the only moment of Japan looking like what you think of Japan as.
Yeah.
Like,
they're
generally pretty ropey, but they have one great breakout from behind their own try line, where three players connect and look effortless and are all reading each other's minds in the way we're talking about Gregan and Larkham doing. And then it just doesn't really happen for the rest of the time. And obviously the entire second half, I think they touched the ball once and knock it on. Yeah. So it's a bit of a difficult second half. But that first 20 minutes, they were in it and it was competitive and they were kind of, you know, milling about. But like, it's kind of a shame we couldn't have seen a few more of those moments in amongst Australia doing that constantly.
Yeah, I did get the feeling that maybe Eddie Jones was the one that first taught Japan how to play like Japan. Like there's all the chat about, you know, they're a small team, they need to be fast and kick and things like that, but I don't think they really owned that.
Yeah.
I think Eddie's the one that really sped the play up to the point where it was their point of difference, whereas in this game, they kind of looked like they knew they needed to kick, but when they did, they were just horrendous little grubbers or chips that the Wallabies very easily covered and then turned the ball over and counterattacked. It definitely wasn't until Eddie where I feel like they really lent into that and did it very, very well.
Yeah, and coined that game plan that now Jamie Joseph, I guess, went on to perfect in 2019.
But it's kind of taking what both of those coaches, Jones and Joseph, have done, is that they've taken things that Japan were always doing as part of their rugby culture and turned it into an entire game plan that is cohesive and works. Like, they've always had a big focus on pre-rehearsed set moves and on pace and on small nines whipping the ball away right away. But they never went, this could be an advantage doing this. Which is what I think Eddie Jones did, is he kind of went like, we can build an entire game out of this rather than just having moments that work in a game, which is what we get.
You get the impression, you know, in this game that, like, they're trying to do what everyone else is doing, they're just not very good at it, you know?
Yeah, which is probably the problem with John Kerwin. You know, like, he is, it's largely what he's going for. And hence, like, there was a controversy in Japan at the time of him picking lots of foreigners, which kind of hadn't been the case beforehand, and he's come in and picked a lot of, like, you know, foreign players because he's like, well, they know how to play rugby. Brings in Kiwis and Tongans and the like.
Bryce Michael Leach would come to nothing.
He kept him on the bench and did bring him on, so I mean, he definitely didn't favor the Kiwis too much.
That's true.
On the bench. But look, it definitely is one of those moments that you can see now, looking back on, that's how they should be playing.
Yeah, right?
It was just by the fluke of it, and maybe they're the moments that someone like Eddie Jones saw and goes, well, this is how we've got to play. You know, this is how we've got to work around, because clearly there's something there when you see those moments, but they were just too few and far between, and clearly weren't thought out at that point.
It's interesting as well, of course, bringing up Eddie Jones. At one point on the commentary, they mentioned that Rocky Elsom has been called out by Eddie Jones for not working hard enough and being a lazy flanker, which he responded to.
Jeez, he was good. I don't know. I thought that was a pretty funny comment, because lazy flankers generally are the ones that just want to run with the ball and they're not doing anything around tackling or rucks. And all he did was just run with the ball really well. So if anything, I feel like he was just an exceptionally athletic attacking threat. I didn't see him do anything else. Well, he didn't need to tackle because the whole team made 10 tackles. Like, what did you want him to do?
11.
I suppose the counter argument, the counter argument then becomes, who needs to work hard when you can score a hat trick?
It's true.
Scoring a hat trick gets you 15 points.
Beric Barnes needed to work harder because he scored 3 tries apparently. Yes. And only got the ball down twice over the line. He wasn't working hard enough to get that third one down. But I don't know where it came from.
Yeah, he scored an invisible try, clearly, that none of us saw. Because the commentators...
To be fair, after 15 tries, it does get hard to know where they went.
It's true. I was thinking, like, is there a try I just wasn't paying attention to? The graphic then comes up saying, oh, that's his second try. You know, he scored 10 points.
I do have a question, guys. You watch a lot of footy. Whatever happened to the water polo-style headgear? Where they, like, coloured out the ears so it looks like you're wearing a water polo cap. Beric Barnes, I thought he was going to make it famous.
It went the same way as the grip pads on the jersey, didn't it? It was probably like a brief innovation of like 10 years into professionalism. Let's try these wacky ideas, and none of them stuck. Fingerless gloves, same era as fingerless gloves.
Yeah.
No one wears fingerless gloves anymore.
This was their era. Like, I know I played rugby at a club that wore green. And I had like this really green headgear, and it was purely because of the likes of Giddo and stuff. And I had the gloves, the Mortlock gloves. And then eventually I lost one. So they became Mortlock gloves that turned into Michael Jackson gloves. And I'm pretty sure we had another flanker as well, where he always wanted to wear one glove. So we'd both wear one for an extended period of time. Like,
This was a pretty, those little moments were pretty iconic things, yeah, I think.
You're really fashionable. You were very fashionable.
I wanted people to know who I was. Bright green headgear, that they know who you are. That was
one glove.
Yeah.
See, I lent my fingerless gloves to that penguin who was crying and it couldn't get them over their flippers. It was a nightmare.
Yeah, see, you're a good player. Yeah,
nice. I try. Poor penguin. Yeah, so Rocky Elsom's free try. I mean, we've kind of talked about two of them, I suppose.
For the third one, the only notes I have is he scores because they don't tackle him.
Yes.
I thought that's how he scored all his tries. Like, he just refused to be tackled at any point. I haven't seen the player stats, but his tackle bus must have been out of this world. He must have had 15 tackle busts.
I think so. It was interesting. The one thing that surprised me about him was they went, he played rugby league at one point, and I didn't believe it. And then there's photos of him. I mean, you guys love your rugby league. So with a guy, John Russell.
Will knows this. No,
yeah,
Will knows.
Yeah.
Thurston, who obviously is this iconic rugby league player. And there's a photo of them both wearing Bulldogs gear. And I don't know if he ever was professionally contracted to them, but they won the year before he went back to, or went across to Union. They won the SG Bull, like under 18s or whatever it was, and he's surrounded by all these huge stars of NRL, and I didn't even know the bloke played a game of league in my life. They kept talking about Barnes as an ex-rugby league player.
Yeah, yeah. They were very excited by Barnes, weren't they, on the comms?
Yeah.
I was at first, like, before the game, I was wondering, why are they constantly talking about when Barrick Barnes is going to get on? Then I realised, oh, it's his test debut, when they brought that up later on. And so, okay, suddenly it makes sense.
He was a freakish talent. Like, I think he played like 5 years of first grade at school or something. And then he was playing for Australia in league and union.
He was really hyped up as a kid, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he was also a state swimmer and an Australian cricketer or something for the juniors. Like, they were saying, I think he's one of his coaches or the principal of the school was saying he's the greatest all-round athlete they've ever seen. Like,
wow.
He was a freak. And I love that he signed for the Broncos in rugby league and then made his debut at 18 years old and almost immediately signed a contract for rugby union. Why did you go to league?
Yeah.
As soon as you made it early in your career, he just buggered off and came back. And man, he was a gun. I love Barrick Barnes.
Yeah, unreal player.
I knew Barrick Barnes was a former rugby league player. I didn't realise he only played one season of rugby league. How often it came up.
Played 6 games or 9 games. That was it.
Nine games.
Yeah. And then immediately went to the Reds and was just like, see ya.
Bye. He played 51 caps for Australia, but he still feels like this player as an Aussie that you sit back and you look at and went, we lost him too soon. Like, he left and went to Japan and should have been in Australia playing for a longer period of time. His last Wallaby cap was 2013, and that's when he went to the Wild Knights. But
27, he would have been.
Yeah. And I think he was very good when he left for the Waratahs. He was very, very good and potentially coming into his prime as a playmaker. Some, up and down moments for the Tars, but he was just such a talented player and too soon in Aussie rugby. I
would argue the prime of his career was every time he played Wales.
That's the prime of most Wallabies careers, though, to be fair.
That's true. Yeah. Including some recent ones.
Yeah. Lachlan Nolligan is now on that list.
That's right.
As an outsider from the Northern Hemisphere, to me, it surprises me that he got 50 caps in a way, because I suppose he spent a lot of time injured, didn't he? And as you say, like, he quit his career early. But at the same time, like, it feels like he had such a, like, long, kind of fulfilled career, because he did so much in whatever games he did play. And, like, we've covered him 2011 as well, and he looked like one of Australia's most important players in that tournament. And, yeah, as you say, he went forward to 2013. That was the Lions tour, was his last kind of set of caps, wasn't it? And I remember at that point he'd moved to fullback, and it was still just like, there's always, like, they have to get him in the team because he's such a kind of triple threat kind of player.
He was coming through then at a time that had Quaid, Kirtley, like all these 10, 15 like playmakers.
Mm. Mike Harris, you know, the lot of them.
Or Sam Norton Knight. I don't know if you guys saw him.
Yeah.
This town is still shaking when there was Sam Norton Knight, I heard. Like, I saw everyone around shudder suddenly.
That's why the Penguins crying
came up.
Oh, yeah. We know, mate. He played for the Waratahs for years. We know.
In fact, any chatter you can hear in the background, any background noise, is entirely people going, remember that game he played against Edinburgh.
Did he go to this World Cup?
He was in the shadow squad. He was in the shadow squad.
The shadow squad.
I think Eric Barnes is 20 years old above him.
That was like a CIA operation, the shadow squad.
Either that or a 90s hip-hop group.
I know, right? I also love that Berrick Barnes at 20 years old, one or two seasons in Union, got picked above him from the Reds team that came dead last in the competition, and their last game of the season was their biggest ever loss in Super Rugby, and still is, 92-3 to the Bulls. So clearly Berrick Barnes
same
wasn't
exactly
line is this? Orchestrating a strong side. I don't know how he was picked. Yeah, well.
It's one point off the same scoreline as this.
That's an article I found. In my brief research on Berrick Barnes from 2007, basically, it was quite controversial at the time that he was brought in ahead of, again, apparently has four young playmakers, right? So Berrick Barnes, 50-cap international, Quade Cooper, 50-cap international, Kirtley Beale, 50-cap international, and Sam Norton Knight. Those four were seen as like the four up-and-comers, and it was controversial that Barnes was the one that got the call at the time, ahead of the others.
For the benefit of the listener, Nelson's head just sunk into his palm.
Yeah, I mean, there's some good names there.
There's Norton Knight.
So. I would say there's generally... I was looking at some of the fan feedback on the squad, and the first comment I saw on the whole squad release was, quote, "What a shite team, not enough Tars. Typical." And if there's one that happens now, like that is, if there's one thing that's typical of Australian rugby, it's never ever been there's not enough Tars. So it was just so fantastic. And clearly, there's a lot of hate for Berrick Barnes over there at the time.
The part of this article on Berrick Barnes being picked says that a part of it is that his bubbling optimism is a big part of him being picked over the other three, because he was just like a really lovely, wanting to learn. Bright spark, you know, up and comer, blah de blah. And apparently that was a huge part of them going with him over Sam Norton Knight.
I mean, you say that, we joke about this, but also you're looking at the other contenders. One of them was Kirtley Beale. Yeah. What a surprise. Like, I mean, I don't know much about Kirtley Beale and what he's like as a bloke, but he comes across like somebody who's almost coasted on talent because he's that good. And he was like a schoolboy prodigy and all the rest.
You know, at 2007, was that his first year out of school? He was very used to people blowing smoke up his ass.
He was 19. Yeah. He was a year younger, so he was only 19 at the time. And there was already chat that he's the future. Yeah. He was very good.
I've seen the videos of him as a high school prodigy.
He trained with the Wallabies at 16.
Yeah, his first year out of school would have been the year before that, and he was the player of the tournament for the Australian Rugby Championship. Yeah, Wanda McCall. Like, he was unbelievable.
That's ridiculous. Of course, the other name is, as you say, Quade Cooper, who, fantastic player, like, clearly quite a good lad as well. But, like, it says a lot about Quade Cooper. Yesterday, I saw he was on Twitter, on one of those little Twitter hangout things, the voice things. Like, he always does these, like, stoner hangouts with, like, NFT bros. And he was talking about Better Call Saul with just some random people on Twitter, like, this time yesterday.
I love the thought. There's no way Quade Cooper watched all of Better Call Saul and got it without wanting to do him down. Like,
I would say, guys, if you could refer to him as 2023 World Cup winning fly half Quade Cooper, it would be much appreciated, just to show some respect.
I think the biggest thing that we take out of this is, like, we Berrick Barnes decided to leave early. We're talking about Quade and Beale, you know, being brought back. What is Sam Norton Knight doing? There's a jersey with his name on it. He's in his prime now, I reckon.
I believe he was actually playing in the Japanese league like 2 years ago still.
I think he's retired.
Like third division. You know,
I'm pretty sure we've now mentioned him three times. He is going to appear in front of me when the coffee shop.
He's barred from Cardiff.
Speaking of players that should be playing now, can I just take a slight pivot? Tatafu Pilota now was 22 years old for this World Cup, and there was some controversy that he was missed out as the third hooker in the squad to Sean Hardman, who no one will ever remember in Wallabies kit.
I've never heard of him.
Exactly. He was the reserve hooker for the Reds at the time, who, as I said, came dead last in Super Rugby. And anyway, so Tatafu was controversially one that missed out. He's now 37 years old. And considering our hooker stocks, I'm just thinking, if all these other blokes can come back, surely Tatafu Polotta now can play.
Yes.
Look, I love Tatafu Polotta now, but he is getting red carded in the first minute of every match he walks on the field now. The diving at the knees first and the tackle. Shit like that. Like, he is, Latu has trying to like model his game around Polotta now, and he's still nowhere near as more likely to get carded. Like, come on, mate. I don't know. Latu's pretty good at getting carded. Oh, maybe off the field if he's big driving, but that's what he wins at for sure. But maybe not on the field. They're both pretty bad.
One of my main memories of Tatafu Polotta now is our I don't know if you remember our dad, Will.
Vaguely.
Do you remember him? Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember our father asked.
Yeah.
I remember only through marriage. I remember our dad, I don't know what that means. Our dad asking, like, what's the name of this Wallabies hooker? Because he's really good. He's always good for them. And it's like, oh, Polotta now. And he was like, Polotta. And he just went, Polotta. And he just called him Polotta from then on. And I very quietly, every now and again, go, it's Polotta now. It's just longer. And he'd be like,
oh, it's Polotta now, is it? Oh, now it's Polotta.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure there was a lot of now puns.
Yeah. Like, apocalypse now? A Plotinlicks now. If I'd been doing what I do now when he was playing, I would have spent 3 weeks on that pun.
10 minutes
and nobody in the comments would have mentioned it. Yeah.
But it's like your dad always thought they were trying to use context of when Polotta did something. Polotta now throws the ball in. Polotta now makes a tackle.
Speaking about hookers, like, it wasn't that long before that, I mean, we really got into rugby and Jeremy Paul was playing. And I had a mate that was Jerry and a mate that was Paul. And my mum took years to figure out, when I'm talking about Jeremy Paul, I'm talking about footy player.
The ongoing joke forever from our dad was Jeremy and Paul were doing something.
Yeah.
She just never got it. Mum never got it.
Jeremy, comma, Paul.
Yeah.
Who would ever have two first names? God.
Yeah. Oh, outrageous.
None of us.
None of us. No one in this chat.
No, not at all.
There's not a single surname in this Zoom call.
Adam Fryer, Adam Fryer was the reserve hooker. I remember, like, I don't know how old he is now. He's probably still playing. I think the bloke's still playing. He's 42.
But he's playing at Randwick, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, when I was playing grade, I remember coming up against him and he was like 37 or something like that. And was still an absolute weapon. And he'd play fourth grade, third grade, second grade, first grade. Like, he'd play every match of the day at, you know, in his late 30s. He was a freakish player, I reckon. Lots of hard work and just a real stocky unit.
Mm-hmm. Fair play. I'm not really familiar with him coming into this. So it's good to know that he's also a good lad who's very committed to playing in his latter career.
He was criticised for his throwing, but Nelson and I, growing up, he was like our favourite hooker because he did this outrageous like squat thing before he would throw, and it was like,
loved it.
It was the only way we could throw a ball in when we were mucking around at the park.
I've thrown one line out in my entire rugby career, like as an adult, and that was at Subbies, like just muck around footy. And I did the bob before I threw it.
This
was like
yes.
3 years ago. And it did not go straight.
Iconic.
And it was called up. And that was the only line out I got to throw. So it didn't work. I thought I was going to make it go straight.
It's a shame. Maybe there's a reason why he's the only person who ever did it.
I think so. probably right.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Just on this Wallabies front row as well, there's something else. Al Baxter, the tight head, is part of a very small group of players that I really like who just quit in order to do another job. Like, he retired from rugby to become an architect, and he was just like, I've just had enough, I just want to be an architect instead. And, like, these come through every now and again. Like, Simon Hammersley last year, plays for Sale, quitting to become a financial consultant. Just because, like, well, you know what, I fancy a change. And I'm a big fan of all of that. There was someone for Leicester quit the other year.
Don Barrow.
Like, Don Barrow. He quit, he just went, I'm just bored of rugby.
Johan Hersen did it, then came back.
Yeah, I quite enjoy that. I quite enjoy players who just get tired of being involved in rugby all day, every day, and just go, you know what, I'm going to do something else.
It's incredible because we hear in the 87 World Cup, like, oh yeah, this player has dreams of doing this one day, you know, being an actor one day or whatever. But here, it's like, oh, they're all professionals. They're all living their dreams now. And Al Baxter still is that guy. Like, he dreams of one day becoming an architect, and he managed it.
He only played rugby in order to go to stadiums because he just loved looking at stadium architecture.
He's gotten in. That way.
Yeah,
that's how you make the connections. Very smart.
Yeah.
Very smart.
He tactically became a pro rugby player.
So gutted that one of his World Cups was at home, so he couldn't go around and admire architecture from different places. Whereas here, he could go and see French architecture. He could have a full nose around Lyon and see all their statues.
By the way, you mentioned that. So we've had a couple of chats off air with the two of you. So all four of us are going to France next year. And we watched this game, and immediately I saw the stadium, I saw the weather and the conditions and the atmosphere and everything, and thought, we're all going to experience this next year. How insanely excited does that make you guys?
Yeah.
Oh, not only that, but guys, are you going to be there for the quarterfinals? Are you there for this whole thing?
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm there the whole way. Yeah.
I'm going home once or twice.
So Will's going home partway through and then coming back. And I'm just out there from like a week beforehand through to the...
I did the go home second coming for Japan. It was amazing. But for this one, my wife has to go home before the quarterfinals. So Nelson and I both have tickets. I have a spare ticket. Our older brother is also going to be in Europe. He's going to fly over and watch it with us. So going to have the trilogy. So if you're around at a pub... He doesn't know very much about rugby at all, but he'll have a great time.
Neither do we. That's fine.
We're very similar to Harry. Doesn't understand rugby very well.
Can I mention something I've just realised? Right? So we're talking about next year. This game takes place in Lyon, which is where Wales play Australia next year.
What?
I mean, Wales play Australia every year, every World Cup, so it was a fair chance. But it's probably the same date. It's
got to be. We're all going to that game, aren't we? We all have tickets for that game.
Yes,
whereas Australia,
yeah.
So the thing is, right, I would say, oh yeah, we should probably do something afterwards, but you're going to beat us, so we shouldn't.
No,
do something before.
Let's not be that confident. We'll do something before. But we do need a wager. We definitely need a wager.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have to figure that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's super exciting though. Just as I say, like looking at the French stadiums and like the atmosphere that created and everything, and going like, oh, we get to experience this soon. Super exciting.
Yeah,
I mean, there's probably no better place in the world to have a World Cup at the moment in terms of just fan excitement and engagement and things. I think that's the key spot I'd be wanting to watch a World Cup at the moment.
Absolutely. Do you want another great stat about that stadium that was being played in?
Go on.
So a few weeks before this World Cup, the Rolling Stones played there, and it was also where David Bowie did his last gig in France.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So there you go. Pink Floyd, Michael Jackson, and Genesis have also played there. There are some stats, pointless stats, about the
Pink
stadium.
Floyd, Michael Jackson, Genesis, and Yuki Yatomi.
Yeah.
Have all played there.
And soon enough, we will have us watching that that's the real game.
Yep.
I don't know what that means. Exciting. I'm sorry to have interrupted that for pointless Bowie facts.
So, a big moment in the game I think we need to talk about, right? There's a point where Australia drop a ball and Hirotaki Onozawa is on it like a puma, right? And Sterling Mortlock The bastard goes, no, you're not having this, and pulls him back. It's almost as controversial as Lottie Takiri's jumper, as far as I'm concerned. It's a huge moment in the game. Australia are, at this point, granted, only 23 points up, but could have been a momentum-swinging moment in the game. So referee Alan Lewis gives Japan the penalty on the 10-metre line. And you boys, you know, there's no drop goal, so I feel like I want to get your opinions on this moment in the game. Were your hearts in your mouths?
Huge. Huge moment. If anything, I thought I purposely didn't go back and look at the result for this one. And I thought this was the turning point. I thought this is when it all fell apart. The Wallabies looked rattled. Sterling Morlock didn't know how to hold the defense back. And of course, the Japanese player, who was their kicker? Who's the 10?
Ono.
Is it Ono that kicked it?
Yeah.
Oh no. He kicks the goal straight through the middle of the post. And it's like it was nothing to him, absolutely nothing.
You knew at that point it was 23-3. They brought it within three tries, and they just scored 3 points. So you go, if we kept going these threes, there are real chances.
They're accumulating now. Yeah. They're accumulating now. It's huge.
So close at that point, I reckon. Right, it, cool.
It means that Australia go in, luckily, 23-3 up as we reach the Bundaberg halftime wrap, sponsored by Panasonic. Rather than just half time, that is what it is referred to
that's
as.
That's another thing that happens during this is they keep seemingly cutting to adverts, and then they'll throw back with a presenter who will then just like step in and go. I mean, I wrote one of them down. He goes, "The running game, Rocky Elsom, 16-0 kick to come," and it's like he's just throwing in these weird like idioms almost about the game. He'll be, you know, he'll step in and go. Jazz, freeform art form. 26-7.
Did any of you see the subliminal advertising that came up at one point? So there was a point where the game did this thing where it faded to black, and it happened a handful of times, and then immediately comes back. But on one of them in particular, there was literally for one frame, it took me ages to actually pause it on the right one, just suddenly, literally for one frame, up comes a link which says www.whychooseplasma.com.au. I went to this website and it no longer exists, that domain. That's a free domain.
Yeah. Well, they were ad breaks. So that's probably just the last frame of the advert someone couldn't cut out.
Genius to actually buy that domain name now with this podcast going out. So I can imagine the traffic is going to skyrocket with all that Squidge and other Squidge have.
Yeah.
It's another, you know, israelfalau.com.
Yeah.
I register that alongside, you know, I until recently I just let it expire. I owned brexitnegotiations.com as well, which I bought for a separate. I was it's a whole other thing. I was doing another show thing. I'd been asked to do something. I asked to do a segment for it, so I emailed a bunch of people from an official seeming account called Brexit at like so and so at brexitnegotiations.com, and I got a few reports. Basically, I was trying to get a famous magician to bless Brett. It made sense at the time.
Lottie
Takiori.
Not a knight.
We can't say his name. He will appear. It was a. No, never mind. Let's not. Let's another time. Maybe.
Why Choose Plasma was advertised during the second half. Momentarily.
What's the answer? Why Choose Plasma?
It's a good question. Well, I tried to find that out by going to the website, and it just says this domain does not exist. It's just like that's lost to history. That the answer to that question. Why choose Plasma?
For some reason, Plasma TVs are no longer thriving. No. Who'd have thought?
Entirely because that website ran out.
Yeah.
They did say that this game was in high definition, and it made me realize that. That's very subjective. It sucks. That wasn't high def.
Was this would have been the first World Cup shot in HD. Yeah. There you are. There's a mildly interesting fact for some people.
Yeah, second game ever shot in HD, this. In the World Cup, that is.
Massive.
So, second half. Yuki Yotomi does a random grubber to Lottie Takiri. I just think, yeah, what a guy. You go, Yotomi. You keep doing you.
Surely we can call the second half the Drew Mitchell half.
Yeah.
Where every time he touches the ball, he just outpaces or runs through people and scores.
Yes.
he made me realize that he was very good. Like, I knew I always liked him and he was always really good. But you just watch this and you go, geez, he's really quick. Like, he's class. Burning yeah. from the outside. And yeah. He does a couple of little shimmies. And...
He's such a, like, properly well-rounded winger that he's a brilliant yeah. finisher with genuine, like, top-end gas, could pass and link up with players, and had a really good boot on him as well. Like, he was a really, really solid winger, and he comes on and scores immediately by just yeah. burning Kitagawa on the outside.
He's got the Andrew Mertens disease, where, like, when you listen to him speak, you forget that he was really good at rugby.
Like, I actually like Drew Mitchell as a pundit. I like him. Hey.
He did one recently.
You mustn't get much of him over there.
He was blind drunk at one of the last games. Absolutely lit. And they kept cutting to him. Like, it was...
You mean when he had no voice?
No, he was blind drunk. He had no voice. He'd been partying at... We've got Aqua Rugby over here. And it was this big event at Manly.
Right.
And he'd been drinking all day and went to a thing that night for a Wallabies match and was on the telly... clearly blind drunk. They kept cutting to him, and most people wouldn't tell because he just doesn't make that much sense most of the time. And he couldn't speak. I think that was why they put him on. He literally had no voice. He was blind drunk.
I think we're onto something here. I think drunk punditry is the way forward.
I think so. Look, we should one day do an episode of this drunk. I don't know why we didn't do that in 87. Maybe when we do 1991, we'll do the whole series hammered.
No. I want to go full in. I want next Six Nations, couple of months' time, right? ITV need a full panel of Brian O'Driscoll, Johnny Wilkinson, and Sir Clive Woodward bladdered.
Well, if you need to sell it to them, sign us up. We'll get drunk with you. We'll just live stream a game and commentate it, especially if it's a show versus Wales at some point, and do that. That'd be some good gear.
That sounds
good. I have heard, I remember hearing somewhere that Squid Rugby had the second most viewers out of any group in all of rugby in the world. That was only second to Rugby World Cup, the International Rugby Board. Wow. And with Bernard Laporte now being stood down, I believe that makes you two the most powerful people in all of the world. If anyone can do it, it's you guys. I think just make a few phone calls, boys. It'll be peace cake.
Make one phone call to Clive Woodward. Be like, look, I've got 20 shots of tequila with your name on them. Let's celebrate your win last month in the 2003 World Cup where you live permanently.
Mitchell will do it for free.
Can you imagine the experiment? How many shots of tequila does it take Clive Woodward to become palatable?
Do we have to do the shots? Or is he doing the shots?
I think he does them.
Okay. Yeah, that would be good. I like it.
Like, no, after two, he'll just start calling for Eddie Jones to resign again. Just be constant.
We're definitely going to do alternative drunk commentating. Make it happen, boys. We're on.
Yeah, board. Yeah.
Yeah, that is the only circumstance under which I will see Clive Woodward on television again.
Be good. Good gear.
Oh, that's incredible.
My brain is just mentally running through any internationals or former internationals I think I could like. So I had a moment this weekend where I was at the Ospreys Leicester game. And like I was in a little like bar beforehand, and a bunch of Ospreys players walked by, and Dewi Lake, Wales hooker, like as he was leaving the room, came up to me and went, "You're right, how are you going? You know, like we know each other slightly, but haven't spoken in a while, and don't know each other well enough to have a proper chat." So I went, "Yeah, all right, how are you?" And he was like, "Yeah, all right," and then walked off. And so clearly he recognised me, but had no idea where from, and came over to just say hi.
Thought you were one of the youngsters in the squad, clearly.
Yeah, very small.
Look, I'd love to see, if we're doing this drunk commentary, Sterling Mortlock get drunk and have a crack at it. Speaking of Japan and Australia, at the last World Cup in Japan, I met Sterling Mortlock and had far too many sakis with the bloke. And he was literally down, so keen to come to karaoke with us. And I was just so in awe of the bloke. So
what did he sing?
No, this is it.
Got scared off by Nelson's huge erection.
It wasn't that big, but it was there. That's what matters.
I immediately put my notebook down when you said all of this. How did he handle his booze?
Oh, he was good. He drank me under the table because it was actually a Wallabies function, and they came. I was drinking whiskey and sake, but mainly Japanese whiskey, and they would come and free pour it from behind your shoulder and fill up your glass. So you couldn't keep count of what you were drinking. And I'm pretty sure he was drinking beer. So I was going like one for one with one of my all-time heroes, talking about his gloves, that sort of stuff. And he's like, I mean, let's go to karaoke. And was selling us on the idea of karaoke. We got downstairs and he's like, oh, I'm too drunk, I can't do it. And he jumped in the cab and left. We went to karaoke's, and this is one of the moments that I've definitely let Japan get on top of me. And I'd ended up vomiting in the waiting room of karaoke. And it's not a typical behavior for me. But the one other Aussie bloke that came up with us and was keen to come just walks over, uses his hands, scoops up all the vomit on the ground and goes and walks over and puts it in the bin. And all I can remember out of that is going,
this a wallaby test player?
No, it wasn't a test player. Yeah, but I just remember sitting there going, thank God Sterling Mortlock didn't come and have this moment ingrained into him if he ever sees me again. And so I'm so thankful he didn't actually come sing karaoke.
Okay, fair enough. That could have been very, not memorable. Memorable's the wrong word. I imagine you don't remember much of it.
Without the vomiting, it could have been, if he came to karaoke, one of my lifetime highlights.
Yeah.
But he...
Hopefully he can recreate that in France. Hopefully one of your wallaby heroes does go on a night out with karaoke with you in France.
Maybe try and make that happen.
Yeah, we can make that happen.
Drew Mitchell will be there pissed.
Yeah, 10 out of 10 would sing karaoke with Drew Mitchell.
See, I had a similar but completely different experience when I was in Japan, in that I once ended up drinking in a room. I later that night ended up in the middle of the square in, I think it was Kamashi, maybe? Kumamoto. In the middle of the square, the police had to come and break it up because we had a game of sevens in the middle of the square that night. All of us drunk, including one, Danish international. Oh, it was a Danish international second row who was clearly class. He was basically in because he was the best lineup operator in Denmark. And the rest of his game was like not as strong, but like he was a great lineup forward.
Forget drunk punditry, drunk rugby, please.
But as we were coming up with this plan, two things happened. One was a guy came over to me and went, I'm very high up in the Fijian Rugby Union and I want to say I like your work. And I was like, great, thank you. Didn't quite know what to say, but was very, very touched. And the other thing was we realized that Shane Williams and Tom Shanklin were drinking in the other corner of the room. And I had a moment of thinking, do we ask Tom Shanklin to come and play with us?
Yes.
Do we ask? As a different bald number 13, I wondered, you know, is a link up to Sterling Mortlock? We did not, but the police did have to break up the game at 2 a.m., which is a huge shame.
We had a game of rugby broken up in Japan as well. Our third podcaster, Kagi. Mm. The tsunami? Not the tsunami. What did they have? The typhoon.
Mm.
Yeah, so we rushed, jumped on a train, got out of the city, and we were in some other city. I can't even remember where it was. Mm. And we went during a lull in the storm. We're like, this is the perfect time. Let's go outside and just pass the footy around and play some touch footy. And there's no one around. So we're playing in the middle of the road. And this police car floors up to us and screeches on the brakes and starts yelling at us in Japanese. And we're like, we don't speak Japanese. Pretty sure we're all probably wearing Wallabies jerseys and stuff. And they're like, go inside. You're not allowed to be outside. I'm like, yeah, that's probably fair. all we want to do is pass a footy in the middle of a big storm.
Because surely if we're talking about people drinking and commentating and personalities in France next year, surely the man has to be Matt Giteau. Not only is he relevant to this pod because he started at 12 and he was the Wallabies backup 9 and 10 as well. But on top of that, he obviously played for Toulon for, 7 years. He's clearly the prince of Toulon. I assume he owns most of the city by this point. he owned a wine company for a little while with Drew Mitchell and Adam Ashley Cooper as well. If there's one person that we can get on the beers or on the wines in France to try and tell some yarns, surely it's Matt Giteau.
Yeah.
Good shout.
Yeah, that's a great shout.
Does love a beer. And, I mean, I'm going to put it there. He's got two sons. They're future Wallabies. His sister married Buddy Franklin, who is one of the best ever AFL players in Australia. And the guy is enormous. So there is some amazing...
And she's played rugby union for Australia, hasn't she, as well? Like, she's got a fair few caps, yeah.
Was it one of... was I think it could have been that his sister did as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Yeah, Christy Gitter,
dual code rugby international.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
So there's a lot of talent in that. That's what we know.
Well, their dad was a rugby league player as well.
Right.
Wow.
And his wife played for one of the franchises in the netball in Australia as well. So there's some good.
Wow. Okay.
Jesus. Yeah. That's just carrying on throughout the family. That gets
this is,
yeah.
Yeah. Like Roman Untermack esque level of like prodigy lined up.
That's very scary.
So sign them up
so,
now.
We're going to get schooled by Matt Gitto's kids in a car park in France next year. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I'd love that.
And then go sing karaoke with Mortlock. Done.
Yeah, that's the dream evening for this pod.
Let's make it happen.
Genuinely, in Lyon somewhere next year when the Wallabies play Australia, let's have a late night game
Wallabies play
in
Australia.
A car park somewhere.
Yeah.
Let's find somewhere in Lyon and we can make this happen.
Yeah, we'll get as many people down as we can. That's fine.
Sounds great.
Adam Ashley Cooper scores a try. Nathan Sharp makes a... Sorry to link back to the actual podcast that we're doing.
We're talking rugby.
No.
Yeah, apparently so. But Nathan Sharp makes a little bit of a break and George Greekin is just on it and follows him up and links up with Ashley Cooper. It's very nice. Always enjoy watching Adam Ashley Cooper score because he always enjoys it as much
great
himself.
Great try. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he doesn't see much of the ball, but like he makes the most of it when he does.
He certainly does.
Focusing on Nathan Sharp for a minute, I kind of went in and out of loving him and hating him when he was playing for the Wallabies. I don't know why. Yeah, he's obviously a lovable guy.
Why did you hate him?
I don't know. Like, there was times where I didn't think he deserved to be selected, times where he was one of my favourites. But he was exceptional as a first receiver. Surely this is the early days when tight forwards were playing as link players.
For
he distributed the ball so much. I think he even set up one of the tries with an inside ball, didn't he?
And he scored a try himself at the start. Yeah.
Unbelievable game.
He was another one of those players who saved all of his best performances to be against Wales.
Yeah.
But it was that thing that we see a lot now where you have a forward kind of position, as you say, a first receiver, then you've got kind of plays out the boot and you can then do further playmaking when you've got someone else there. Like Nathan Sharp being so good at that and making those decisions last second is, what are we talking, like 10 years ahead of his time?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Like 8 years at least?
Yeah,
probably ahead of that becoming like a widespread tactic, but just because he was great at it, they could do that early. Like, there's a couple of points where Larkham's bringing in like pods of forwards to play off 10 and so on in that very similar system. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's really interesting the Wallabies are doing that are kind of, as I said, like, are now catching on.
By the way,
2 meter man, 2 meters as well. He's not just your flanker that you're slotting in, the bloke's 2 meters tall.
Yeah, it's insane. Can we quickly talk about the George Smith try, please? Because he is a freak. So he, first and foremost, like chases a kick and sprints into the Japanese half, right? Australia tackled Japan, set up a breakdown the edge of the 22. And then, he flies off the line, nails, it's Vatavai he nails as well, isn't it?
Taira, the outside centre.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Taira, that's it. He nails him. And then before, he nails him without even falling on the floor himself. So he stays on his feet the entire time. At this point, the law stated that the tackler didn't have to get back on side, could just pick up the ball. And Tyra dropped the ball. Smith picks it up and just runs into the corner. Next level.
He does a little cheeky dive as well. Like,
yeah.
He, as someone who grew up playing flanker, he was an absolute god. Like the things that he could do. You know, and he'd kick the ball, he'd throw cutouts, he'd do flicks. Like, he was just this. I remember when he came back to the Wallabies and to Australian rugby in the end of his career, and Hooper and Pocock were both running around at the time, and obviously both exceptional players in their own right. And he strolls back into Super Rugby, age 33, 34, something like that. And he ended up finishing the season with more turnovers than Pocock and more runs and tackle busts than Hooper.
I did a weekly stat.
How is that possible at that age to be that freaking good?
The stuff he managed at the end of his career was just genuinely insane. He got English Premiership Player of the Year playing for Bristol at the age of 39, I believe, which is just ridiculous. Like, he was, like, throughout his career, seen as, like, one of the world's most perfect rugby players, and rightfully so.
There's,
just next level.
Eddie Jones said about him that he plays like he's covered in spiders because no one ever wants to touch him. Which he you get a real sense of that in both him making the tackle and then his break afterwards. Mm. And he's his hair as well.
Single-handedly my most favourite player, I think, ever to take a running field. He's that good.
Yeah.
And he had a brother as well, Tyrone Smith. Did you guys know anything about his brother?
I didn't know he had a brother.
Yeah, he was a centre, played Brumbies, stuff like that.
He was pretty solid too, to be fair.
He was. He'd put some hits on in the centres, but, I mean, he was nowhere near.
It wasn't like the exceptional world-class talent like of George Smith. It's no, that's fair enough. It's fair enough. We've got, I think, two more tries that we can.
One thing on George Smith. Very quickly. Just like, so his hair stands out because he does not look like the George Smith you remember at this period.
No.
Because in January of that year, of 2007, sort of December, January, he had shaved his head off, cut all his dreadlocks off.
Shaved his head off?
Yeah, it was. He saw that one tackle earlier where someone had his head taken off and went solidarity with Cregan. Yeah, fellow George has got to stick together. So, yeah, he shaved the dreadlocks off and gave some of them directly to kids with cancer, and the other ones he auctioned off to raise money for them. And then this is it slowly starting to grow back, and it looks mad as a look if he'd chosen it, but it's him trying to grow his dreadlocks back at the time.
Yeah. To quote Ben Tune on the comms, rubbish haircut, great try.
Yeah, Ben Tune, who scored in a World Cup final, which is the one fact worth knowing about him.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But the commentator mentions a few times now, if anyone knows about knee injuries, it's Ben Tune.
Yes.
That's pretty rough.
Speaking of, at one point, the Wallabies bring on Mark Gerrard, and I go, oh, Mark Gerrard's on. Because I've only seen him play for the Wallabies once, and that was his final test against Samoa, where he was terrible. So that is kind of my memory of Mark Gerrard as a Wallaby. But he comes on for about 2 minutes, then goes off. So literally I've written down Mark Gerrard on, ellipsis, and then it's like, oh, Mark Gerrard off. So it was very short turnaround.
He's a funny player, Mark Gerrard, because I remember him being a pretty good player. Like, he was great. Yeah.
He was very good. And the back end of his career, I think he got better.
I think he had quite a few injuries as well for a few years there. But, yeah, no, he was a pretty good player. But, yeah, it was within a couple of minutes he was taken off injured. And the Wallabies decide, John Connolly goes, you know what? We'll play with 14 men. That's fine. We don't want to risk anyone else getting injured. We'll play with 14. That's fine.
Yeah. And there was no issues, realistically.
Shortly after this, Mark Gerrard goes on to play for Tonga in a coronation match to celebrate the King of Tonga.
What?
I don't know either.
There we go.
He's now 40 years old. He's still playing third grade footy for Warringah in the Shoot Shield. And he's 191 centimetres. He's a big man, but he was pretty lean back then. He is now not lean. He is substantially wider. And his son plays, I think, at 10 or 12 for Warringah, third and fourth grade as well.
Okay.
So the two of them are running around together, and he's still
up. Like, yeah, no, I've got to respect that. That he's so played for long enough that he's playing with his son and clearly doing well.
His sister also played for Australian netball, similar to what we were saying about the Gitter. It was like clearly a big sporting family.
Yeah, fair play. Fair play. Credit where it's due. We'll wrap up these last two tries, I think. There's Berwick Barnes makes that scores that second try where Drew Mitchell makes a little bit of a break and just kind of links up with him. That's not much to really say about that, I don't think. Gitto's good in that he has the last touch on the ball before giving it to Barnes. He could have picked his man to give that to, really.
Yeah.
Oh, there's the Latham one as well, where we've talked about it already. Yeah. But the notable thing about Latham's first kick, which we forgot to mention, he chips a medic.
I missed that.
That whole phase play is mental. The physio is hunched over the hooker for Japan, who is face down, and Japan play at the injured player for about two phases in a row.
Why did they avoid him?
Play through, like play on. It's all okay.
Yeah.
That's really better. And as you said, they put that little dumb grubber through. Latham picks up and immediately runs straight at the same player before putting that chip over. It's just like, why are you constantly targeting this poor bloke on the floor?
Guys, we all know that's where the gaps are.
Yeah. They were.
Yeah. It's smart footy back in the day, all right?
Drew Mitchell scores another try where Matt Dunning, what a break, and what a miss pass as well.
Oh,
He wanted to will him to go.
It was a basketball.
No, it was a long ball to Berrick Barnes. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. And then Mitchell just finishes that off. Looks very easy for someone like Mitchell. Great step inside as well. And the final try is scored by Fryer. Last play of the game. Try from short range. I believe that's all the tries done. We've done the last few in quick succession because we're approaching the 2-hour mark. But
there's one great set move that Japan run off a tap penalty where they set up their entire team and they take ages waiting for everyone to set up. And then we have Yamamoto passes to Ono, who just kicks it dead.
Yes.
Wise move.
That's brilliant.
And it's like Lottie Tinkuri sees that ball coming towards him and goes, go on then.
Oh, yeah.
Go on then. I know where this is going.
Yeah, he just gave him some space behind it and just left him. But
yeah,
I mean, that's the safest place for the ball to be for Japan, isn't it? Out of field. Mm.
Yeah, I think so.
Very safe. And then, I mean, they choose to do a scrum, don't they? And anyone can win a scrum in this match. You know, anything can happen. So quite smart, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good thinking.
Yeah.
Playing Allen rules.
Yeah.
Okay, should we do man of the match and dick of the day? Is there anything else to add on the game before we get there?
That's it, I think. I think we've covered it reasonably well in 2 hours. It went longer than the match itself.
Yeah. So should we start quickly, man of the match?
Sure.
Will, do you want to start?
Yeah, go on then. So I've got a few names written down. Rocky Elsom, talented, clearly. Matt Gitto was kind of the link man a lot of the time, and I just love watching him play generally. Nathan Sharp, good around the park. And Drew Mitchell off the bench was just fantastic, I thought. I think he took every opportunity that came his way. But man of the match for me has to be George Gregan. He just, as I say, like, he controlled the game in the first half when he had to, and then he let rip in the second half. So, yeah, Gregan for me.
He was absolutely brilliant, but I can't go past Rocky Elsom. The bloke was just incredibly damaging every single time he touched the ball. This was like him in his absolute prime, lightning quick, massively dominating contact, scored 3 tries, was actually named man of the match, which I feel like has got to give me some credence here as well. But man, phenomenal. Rocky Elsom all the way.
Yeah, good call. Nelson?
Our rules are that we're going to say something different. Is that our rules?
No, you can say whatever. Say anyone, yeah, go for the same person, whatever.
Nah, it's got to be Rocky Elsom. How devastating he was, and seeing the man stride out and through the line that many times, score 3 tries as a back rower. He was outstanding. The only disappointment was to hear that he played league. That's the only thing that he did wrong.
I noticed, Nelson, we both picked in our position.
Yeah.
It's probably a friend.
Can't argue too much with Rocky Elsom. Like, obviously, plays incredibly well. Stephen Ockham plays really well. As you said, like, the Ashley Coopers, the Gittos, the Mitchells, the so on, Eric Barnes. I also want to mention Yanisori Watanabe for Japan, the number 6, who has the sort of game that if his team had been competent around him, you go, he's been a real thorn in the Wallaby side. You know, he's been such a menace for them, such a pest for them to get rid of. Except everyone else was so incompetent, it became he'd complete a 1 breakdown and the ball would be 1 second slower in allowing the Wallabies to beat the other defenders very easily.
Sadly, he's only 1/15th of the team.
Yeah, so he was sort of all over, like, putting his body on the line, doing all of the hard work. But when the rest of your team is useless, you kind of can't do anything. But, right, I am going to go, we're going like a straight split down brother lines. I'm going for George Gregan as well.
Very nice.
I thought George Gregan was just exceptional, added so much, decision-making excellent, assists about 18 tries. Yeah, just outstanding.
Yeah. We've got joint players of the tournament here, just off the basis of this podcast.
These two joint with Gareth Edwards. So, dick of the day.
Well, I've got two guys written down, right? One of them is that medic who Chris Latham chipped, right? So, for starters, it's not just that, right? At one point, when Japan are selectively attacking around him constantly, he accidentally trips up on Ozawa. Onozawa was like backpedaling to get into position and he trips over the medic. He's one name I've written down. But my dick of the day has to be Sterling Mortlock because he celebrates winning the toss. That before the game, they go the toss.
I love that.
And
I genuinely went, that's great. That is good.
Flexes
good
his game. Arm in front of the Japanese captain, Sasaki, and like celebrates it full on. And then he says to the referee, like, oh, I want to go this way. And then Alan Lewis says back to him, like, no, you're thinking of the other way. So he not only celebrates the winning the toss, but he gets his directions wrong afterwards. So my dig of the day is Stirling Mortlock.
You've really split us, because I'm the medic on the field normally, and I hated watching that guy almost get trampled so many times. And Nelson's absolutely the guy that celebrates in someone's face about winning a toss.
Fuck yeah. I love that. I'm pretty sure I wrote down that I loved that moment. Like, that was the first note I had. Stirling Mortlock, captain, cheering, winning. And look,
imagine how good he would have been at karaoke if he's got that energy at coin toss.
If I see him now, I can talk about him celebrating.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's true. But the thing is, like, he wins that coin toss. Just wait till he sees the result of the game.
Yeah. You guys won pretty well too. Yeah. You ran through a lot of people.
For the dick of the day, I mentioned before, I'm gonna put up Chris Latham. Because it's not often that a front rower, specifically one in the mould of Matt Dunning, calls for a chip and chase down the blind side from the halfback, and then would have actually scored if it wasn't for Latho blowing past him and would have knocked the ball on a metre out from the line. So it would have been some try for Matt Dunning, and he was absolutely robbed by Chris Latham.
Oh, well, Chris Latham does justify it by scoring a drive over try himself. So
yeah, that doesn't make Dunning feel any better.
Look, I'll go my dick of the day. I think this is quite a tough one, but George Gregan definitely would agree that it's Alan Lewis, the ref, getting in the way of a set piece play.
Yes.
I mean, the commentators talked about it. He's clearly going to get the George Gregan stare there. Lottie was unhappy about it too. I mean, what sort of brilliance did we miss there? There wasn't many moments of brilliance in that match, or many chances for the Wallabies, and he really screwed that one up for them.
Yeah. He really, really kept that scoreboard down.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of keeping the scoreboard down, I've kind of got three nominations. One is Japan in general. Okay. One is John Kerwin for Japan in general. And the other one is Tatsuki Iwata for being injured.
He could have turned the game. He could have changed the game.
Is Tatsuki Iwata. Because who knows what this game could have been very, very different.
They might have won
playing, you know?
They might have won with him.
Look, he could have clawed back single-handedly, what, like 50 to 60 points?
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe they've only lost by 40.
It's incredible. We're one Wallabies game into here, and Sam Norton Knight has got out unscathed. He's not got a nomination. Nor is Anthony Fainga.
Ah! So there it is. No, it's a branch of Barclays. So, Harry Nelson, thank you very much for joining us. Where can people find you? Where can people find Draft Rugby? Please tell us everything.
It's just at Draft Rugby on any of your socials.
Definitely most active on Twitter. So that's where we'll be. We have just released the Royal Rumble with some of the other rugby podcasts.
Yes.
This is always great fun. So that was our kind of year in review. So highly recommend that one, I guess, with some of our good friends there. And then we'll probably be most active again leading into Super Rugby early next year, mid-Jan, something like that, where we start all our previews, things like that as well.
That's pretty. Could I also ask you both to plug your like personal accounts, because they're both very much worth following for anyone
with
any interest in Australian rugby?
Yes, I will double check what my account is.
I am at Harrisondale 88.
Look, I've got a couple. Nelson H. Dale. But if you want to get my one with the biggest following, it's at Adam Brutt, sir. I have 78,000 followers. It's a David Attenborough parody account that I don't use. So feel free to like that, because I feel like I can sell that one day for some money. So.
There we go. It's going to have a bigger following and bigger influence on world rugby than Squid Rugby has one day. But
absolutely, undoubtedly.
Yeah, thank you both for doing this again.
When I get arrested for corruption in 6 months' time.
Yeah. Next in heir to the throne. No, gee, thank you for coming on. This is always like a real highlight of each series, I think, doing the Wallabies game where we just talk about them running riot. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed this, as always. So, we'll see you on whatever our next World Cup is, no doubt.
Looking forward to it, fellas, and we'll see you next year in France.
We'll see you in France.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to keep in touch about that nearer the time. That'd be great.
Ready for your sevens.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for doing it. No, that's been wonderful. That's been a very lovely time. Thank you. I'm off to go and just try and get the Sam Norton eye out of everything, because he is now every face I see. And we'll see you next week for Italy against New Zealand in the Rugby World Cup, which is another very tight encounter in the same spirit as this game. Thank you. Thank you once again, Harry. Thank you, Dale. Nope. Thank you.
Thank you, Nelson. First names.
Thank you, Will. Thank you, Owen.
The other Harry.
Yeah. Thank you all. And yeah, goodbye.
Bye.
Hooroo.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.